Ladies and gentlemen, happy new year. Hopefully the year started off well for you, and welcome to the Off Track Podcast, a meeting of unknowing minds. Thank you for joining us and making us one of the top rating podcasts in the country. This week, we have an incredible guest. We have the head coach of Hoka Naz Elite, Ben Rosario. He's going to be sitting down talking with the panel regarding not only his culture of his program, how he got there, what some of the best accomplishments he had were, and as well, why you should actually pay for a track and field meet on TV, and as well, what a day looks like in a pro coach. So sit back, relax. We all learned a ton from this, and we look forward to hearing what you think. Ladies and gentlemen, it's great to have you here back on the first edition of the brand new podcast, the brand new brand, the brand new name. We brought in some new heat. We got a great new guest to start the year for us with the Off Track Podcast, a meeting of unknowing minds. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. And it is great to be your host, as always, Matt Eshe. Let's dive right into our panel. We'll dive right into our guests. First and foremost, up in the Northeast, he's burying himself or getting out of about 14, 16 inches of snow. You never know. Mr. Mike Nelson, he is gracious with his presence finally. Mike, how you doing?
Doing great, man. Doing great. Wife let me off the hook tonight for a little bit, so here I am.
Man, you might have to pull some strings. You have to get some flowers, do something special to get back in those good graces. So, a man who's a guy who just realized he still has a track despite the fact all the birds legitimately shit on it. Scott Williamson out there in Nevada. How you doing, buddy?
Doing good. I'm probably not going to have high jump practice for a few days till that gets cleaned off, but we're doing well. So. Looking forward to tonight's topic.
Man, that's no doubt about it. That thing looked dirty. No questions there. Who now has read all his books, so he's cleared off his bookshelf. He's got to go back to Crate and Barrel or IKEA or something like that and get something to read done. Mike Erb, how's Bloomington treating you, buddy?
Bloomington's good, man. Good to be back here in town, getting rolling. Nice little break from a kind of a stressful day, so this will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think we can all say we need some fun, some stress relief after all. Mm-hmm. All the bullshit that went down. Let's just put it that way and leave it there. We've got a gentleman who's trying to stay warm in St. Louis in the Lou, Mr. John Bell. What's going on, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Yeah, Mike just said it's been a bit of a stressful day. My mind, I think it's going to be a little bit of a challenge to talk about track and field tonight, given everything that we've watched today. But we'll make the best of it. And I am actually looking forward to this conversation. It's been good to see you. It's been a while. But it'll be a good conversation.
Good to see you, John. Good to see you.
And then we'll jump ahead. We'll change it a little bit real quick. We'll go to him because he just mentioned it. Our guest tonight, we'll get to the other two panelists here in a quick second. Sorry, gentlemen. But our guest tonight is probably one of the nation's best best track and field coaches. Has done an incredible job with the Hoka Naz Elite program out there. Just put on the marathon project, which had unbelievable success and just incredible stuff. And he's been in many different places, many different hats in the running world and the track field community. I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to let him do it here in a second. But before we do, just want to welcome Ben Rosario, Coach Ben Rosario. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you guys for having me. Yeah, it's nice. Mike told me you had some great guests. So I listened to the Vinland Anna podcast that you guys did. It was great.
The thing is, you just went straight to the top. So everything else from down there, just go.
Well, that's why I stopped right there. I wanted to quit while I was ahead.
I can understand that. We've got Tom Sagan's brand new house, sitting back and relaxing a little bit. How have you put the house together?
Still got boxes all over the place, but I'm doing all right. Slow but surely.
I see you're hiding some books there in the corner just a little bit. So maybe it looks like you got something going on. Oh, yeah.
Got a couple books down there.
Got a few things.
Trying to up my game. Got to be like Mike.
We all want to be like Mike,
right? Mine, yeah.
We've got in the valley. He's got some kids rocking around. You know what? That's what happens on a podcast. That kind of stuff goes on. Mr. Darren Flowers. Darren, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. This is the real man of the house right here. Cohen, this is my little guy. He runs the roost.
Man, I figure he does. He's probably
say hi, man. Here too. You say hi? Yeah. He wants to say hi.
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 What's up, buddy?
What's up, bud?
he's ready for the new year. New panelist.
Man, I think we're all looking forward to the new year. But Ben, let's come back to it, man. Again, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you listened to the Vin one. I think you provide a lot of information. I want to jump into this right away because I've known you a little bit. I've never met. I should need to preface this. I've never met you before. Mike talked a lot about you before. raved about you, which good or bad things, you never know what the hell goes on. But no, Mike has actually said some great things about you. And honestly, off the cover, I've always dug in, do the research on our guests here tonight. But the one thing I know you as is the Northern Arizona Elite coach, the Hogan NAZ Elite coach. And that's it. If I didn't look up the bio and that kind of stuff. So I'm going to believe you're at Truman State. I knew that before, if I'm not mistaken, you went to Truman State. So do us a favor. Where did this start? How did you get going? What's your background?
Yeah, Mike had prepped me yesterday, and he said he wanted me to really dig in. And I mean, I'm happy to do that if that's what you guys want. I kind of have this quick version that I always give, but I'll try to dive in a little further. So, yeah, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, where John lives, and knew Mike as a kid, as a teenager, and then we were college teammates. So Truman State is a little Division II school in Northeast Missouri. Near the Iowa border. I ran there from 98 to 03, so very different time in our sport, I think. The standards have been raised quite a bit since then, but I was able to talk my way into a spot on the Hansons team, so the Hansons Brooks team in 2003. I joined the team. In fact, it was just the Hansons running shop team when I joined, technically. Brooks came on board that fall, probably because I joined, is what I figured.
Probably, absolutely, no doubt.
No, but no, I was there for that whole thing. I was there for them signing the deal with Brooks, which was really exciting. It was a cool time to be at the Hansons because Brian Sell was just coming into his own and just mm-hmm. getting really good, and the team was just getting a lot better, and we were getting ready for the 04 Olympic Trials Marathon, and that was a blast in Birmingham. And of course the trials have become an amazing event now. It's, you wouldn't believe how few people were in Birmingham compared to how many people were in Atlanta. It's two different worlds, but which I'm happy about, of course. Let's see. So I ran for the Hansons for 2 years. I did run at those trials in 04, but you know, I wasn't one of the best guys or anything. And it's tough, you know, it's, only the very best people make money in the sport. And I was not one of those people. So I remember going on, I don't know if this still exists, monster.com. This was like the summer of 2005. This is where you used to find jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, I had no money and I was thinking about maybe leaving. I just broke up with a girlfriend and I was just kind of down. I loved the team. I loved Kevin and Keith and my teammates, but you know, again, I wasn't really a professional runner. I was a semi-professional runner, which means I wasn't making any money. So anyway, I went on monster.com and I typed in running because that's really all I knew. And I think I must have typed in St. Louis because of course I had connections there. And sure enough, there was a job open at the St. Louis Marathon for the special events director. And so I applied for that job that summer of 05 and I got that job. So I moved back to St. Louis. I remember I had $7 in my bank account and I moved back to St. Louis. I was 25 years old and I started working at the marathon and I was doing their kids programs and they had this mature mile program for seniors. I was running that, obviously helping out with the race as a whole. It was a lot of fun. But almost immediately when I started that job, Matt Helbig, a good friend of mine from college and Mike's, he and I started talking about starting a running store. This is 2000, it's fall of 05. So by the spring of 06, we were pretty much all in on this thing. We had the business plan written. We had scraped some money together. I actually got second at the Twin Cities Marathon in the fall of 05 and won $20,000, which was more than I had won in my 2 years at Hansons. So that was kind of nice. So I used that money. Matt used some money he had saved up from working adventure trips out west, and then we scraped some money together from friends and family, and I guess long story short, we opened our store in August of 06 called Big River Running Company in St. Louis. So we opened our first store in 06. I remember we were down to less than $10,000 in the bank account the first week of business. We started with $60,000, which is way less than you're supposed to start with. You're supposed to start with $250,000 or something. But we only had $60,000 and we were down to less than $10,000. But on the very first Saturday, we did $9,000 in sales and we never missed a payment. We were never behind. We were never in a bad spot. We just worked really hard, and we did, you know, all the regular stuff that stores do with group runs and things. But we did a lot more than that. You know, we got super involved in the community. We really created a community around the store, and I'm very proud of what we did there. We opened a second location in 2008 and then a third location in 2010. But it was a lot of work. So I was working 24/7. You know, I remember at one point looking at the calendar and realizing I'd been at the store almost all day, every day for 74 straight days. And that kind of stuff is just stupid, really. And a lot of it is my fault because I just said yes to everything. And I was sort of the face of the store. Matt did the business stuff. And then I would do all the coaching, the training teams, and being at all the group runs, and, you know, speaking at the YMCA about the value of running and what running shoes are all about and all that kind of stuff. And my wife and I had our first or our only child in 2011. And by the fall of 11, I just said, this is unsustainable, you know? So, but the store was rocking and rolling. They didn't really need me anymore. The next step was really the challenge of margins and turning the inventory over, and that wasn't really my bag anyway. So I asked Matt if we could have a chat, and he was totally understanding, and we worked out a buyout, and he bought my half of the business, which was nice. Gave me a chunk of change to do whatever the heck I wanted for a little bit, and I kind of like to do whatever the heck I want. So we moved to Flagstaff, Arizona, Jen and I and our daughter Addison, in 2012, in March of 12. Okay. And I took a job with McMillan Running Company. I know Greg McMillan, and he had the Adidas McMillan Elite team here in Flagstaff at that time, but that wasn't really my role. My role was marketing for his online coaching business. And so I did that for a year. It was fine, but, you know, in fairness to Greg, I really probably should have never done that because my head wasn't in it. My heart wasn't in it. I just needed a break. You know, I didn't really need the money, but it felt like you should have a job, you know, if you move somewhere. So after a year of that, you know, my wife and I tried a couple of different things, but I started coaching a couple of, you know, elite runners here in Flagstaff and started having some success. And so by the fall of 13, I kind of knew, you know what, Jen, and she was on board. I kind of knew this is what I wanted to do. Let's just scrap all this other stuff. Let's just put some money into the team. Let's start a team. I know we can do this. I know how to do this. I was on the Hansons. Obviously, I've studied the sport. I know business. I know marketing. I know how to create a brand. All of the things that I had done in my past life really set me up well, or to that point, I should say, set me up well to start the team. So we launched the team in January of 2014, which was great timing. And I wouldn't have done it otherwise. Greg's team was dissolved. So his team dissolved at the end of 13. I would have never gone against Greg. He's a friend of mine. No. But he was done with it. He was moving on to just focusing on his online coaching business, which then opened the door for Stephanie Bruce and Ben Bruce and Kellen Taylor and Scott Smith, people that are all still on the team today. They needed a group. So we formed our group with those four and Matt Yano and Amy Van Alstyne and a couple others. And, you know, that was it. Northern Arizona Elite. We launched it in 14, always with the idea that we would turn this into a business and always with the idea of creating a brand that would be valuable for sponsors. And so Jen and I spent that whole year, 2014, you know, putting money into the team, understanding that it was a necessary thing to do. You had to spend your own money to eventually create what you wanted to create. And we were constantly building sponsor decks and pitching the team. And by the end of 14, it was getting a little hairy because we still didn't have a sponsor. And we had spent about $40,000 that first year of our own money. And eventually you're just like, well, I can't just waste my whole life savings, you know? So I wasn't going to probably go too much longer, but we brought on Josh Cox, agent extraordinaire, agent to Des Linden and others, to start pitching our team and brokering a deal for us, which was a huge move. And in the winter of 15, Kellen Taylor ran a 2:28 debut, which was the sixth fastest marathon debut for a U.S. female at the time, which gave us a little more leverage. Leverage is good. We had already won a couple national titles the first year. We won the cross country national title, 25K national title. But anyway, we ended up having three shoe companies looking at us at one time. So in addition to Kellen's marathon, we had these three companies kind of all interested, which again created leverage, and we ended up going with Hoka. It was unbelievable. I mean, such good fortune, because you know the company has been amazing to us and really amazing as a whole. They've just been done nothing but grow. So we signed that contract in 2015. We signed a second contract with them a couple of years later, and now we just signed our third contract with them this past year. That it starts now. It started January 1st. So that'll take us all the way through 2024. And you know, it was a huge increase this last contract, and we have a lot of support from them, and we can compete now, I think, with anybody in the country and in the world. So that's there you go. Mike, was that thorough enough?
Yeah, one thing. The first employee at Big River Running that really made the difference.
Yeah, well, Mike was our first employee. So like I said, Matt and I, we worked every day all day. But we thought, you know what? Maybe that's not healthy. Maybe we should take Sunday off. The store is only open noon to five. Couldn't we just get somebody to go in there from noon to five? And Mike is a charming man, and he was a very charming young man. And so we thought, well, surely someone of his ability to schmooze people could talk people into buying shoes. So he worked for us on Sunday afternoons from noon to five for about a year, right, Mike?
About a year, yeah.
We lived together also. So the store was about 20 minutes from where we lived. So I remember almost every Sunday at 11:30 yelling up the steps, Mike, you got to get to the store.
That is true.
That's actually,
and I think more than once, I think you came in and caught me sleeping in the back.
Oh, those were good times, man. We were so young, 26 years old when we opened those stores, and there's no way I could do it again. I have the utmost respect for the store owners around the country, because I know how much work it is to make those things go.
And that's, you know, that was the time frame when I, you know, I had run with Ben in college. And at this point I was living with Ben, and I was a part of the store, but I was so impressed with Ben's work ethic. I mean, every day, because you left out the fact that you were still running at almost a better level, you know, than you were when you were running with the Hansons. You ran 4:03 in the mile, you know, after marathon training. You were still running at an extremely high level, still putting in about 100-mile weeks. And I just remember day after day after day, you know, 6 a.m., 8 miles in the morning, going to work all day, and then going back out to run, and then doing the group runs. And this was not like you did that twice a week. This was every single day.
Yeah, I remember at the West County store, you know, if I would stay till close, which was 8, it would be dark. And there was no streetlights out there like there are in the city. So the only place I could run out there was this little industrial park, because they had the parking lot was lit up. So I would just go to that parking lot and just run laps around this parking lot until I got to 4 miles. And then I would go home, because yeah, I knew if I went home, I wouldn't do it. So I was just like, I got to do it now. And so I would just do it out there and then drive home.
The work ethic was incredible. Just absolutely relentless work ethic. And I also remember that at one point very early on, another store had talked about you guys maybe combining, and even said something to the effect of you guys like, hey, well, we might put you guys out of business if you guys start this business you're talking about. And you just looked at them dead in the eye and said, I don't fail.
And well, and I just, think what he said, yeah, I think his wife said something to us to the extent of, you know, this guy's name just doesn't want to see you fail. And I said, ma'am, with all due respect, I've never failed at anything and I don't plan to start now. And we just basically walked out of there, and that was the end of it. They're no longer in business.
Yeah.
Big River's still going, right? Am I correct?
Big River's still going strong. Yeah.
Yeah. They've done an incredible job, but it shows, you can hear the testament right there. Man, with due respect, no disrespect, I don't fail. You can hear right there. There's no question that when you took over Nazalit, or when you started Nazalit and you took it over from McMillan Racing, like this wasn't going to fail. You were bound and determined to make that kind of stuff happen. What's been, other than maybe securing a sponsorship, what's been some of the biggest challenges you faced?
Of course, early on, it's a challenge because you don't have the brand yet to attract anyone you want. You can't be picky, you know, so you have to take on some athletes. And plus, you don't even know your culture yet. You know, I talk about culture a lot, and I think some coaches make the mistake of writing down their culture before they have their culture. The culture is built organically over time. And so when you start a group from scratch, you don't have a culture yet. You have an idea of what you'd like to do, but it takes time, and it takes, you know, the athletes are a big part of that. And so, you know, we probably had some folks come through that weren't the right fit for us, and vice versa, you know, to be fair, early on. And so some of those things are a challenge, but I think that we've worked on that. And I think now we have a very good idea of who is the right kind of athlete for us and who we'd be the right fit for. And so that has really gotten better over the years. What else has been tough? You know, of course, if you're going to have failures along the way, and failures are tough, as you guys know, in coaching. I mean, it's never fun to, you know, expect to make the Olympic team and then get fourth. We were fourth twice at the Olympic trials in 2016 on the track and the 10,000, and that's not fun. You know, but overall, it's all worth it. It's great. And the best thing about coaching, in my opinion, is that, as opposed to the stores where I said, you know, we got to a point where you're just living the same year of your life over again, and you're just trying to get better margins. And that's not really interesting to me. But in the coaching world, every segment is a new challenge, right? And each athlete has a new goal. And actually, in the pro world, it's even more, to me anyway, different than the college world, because maybe Scott Fall was getting ready for the Boston Marathon. Maybe Steph Bruce is getting ready for the London Marathon. Maybe Rory Linkletter is going to focus on the track. You know, there's all these different things that we're focusing on. And so there's all these new challenges. And I just get really excited whenever a new segment is starting, kind of like right now, actually, as we get ready for what is now the Olympic year. So, I'm just very fortunate, and I feel super happy about everything.
So I got a question. I'm going to jump into the pro circuit here for a second, if you don't mind. Okay. So you've had some challenges, which again, we've all had before and that stuff. Do you have a performance or performances? I don't want to pick out one athlete, but, or maybe there was one athlete that performance has been one of your favorite performances as a coach.
Yeah, there's so many. I'll just give you a couple, but it's not that they're above the others. It's just for the sake podcast. Absolutely. But I mean, you know, I'll go backwards from now, most recently. So, you know, they had that track meet in December in California, and we went out there to try to run fast at 10,000 meters, and 31:25 for the women was the Olympic standard. And we had three women get it, which is pretty cool. I think only 9 women have done it in the U.S., and we have 3 of them on our team. It was Steph Bruce and Kellen Taylor got it. Actually, Kellen ran 31:15. Steph ran 31:24. And it's not that wasn't fun, but we kind of figured they would get it. But Danny Shanahan ran 31:22. And her PR before that race was 32:22. And ooh. Danny, coming out of college, was, you know, probably not even someone who we would take nowadays, but this is like 2.5 years ago. She went to Loyola Marymount. She was never an All-American. She was good, ran like 15:50 and, you know, 32:50. But, you know, again, not really the type of stud we get nowadays, like Matt Baxter and Tyler Day and Alice Wright and all these people. So I think because of that, I think she probably, you know, she would even tell you, didn't see herself as being on the same level as some of these other athletes like Kellen, like Steph, like Alafine, et cetera. And her and I had a nice talk at the beginning of the fall, and she knew that it was time to make a jump, you know, and she knew that, and I knew that. And I'm telling you, she ran like a woman possessed this fall after that talk. And it kind of reminded me, and I think it's good for coaches to remember that, like, these kids can handle it. You know, they can handle the truth. You'd be better off to tell them the truth, you know. And we had a very truthful conversation, and she, it lit a fire under her. And I'm not taking all the credit. I mean, she took it on herself to make a change and jump up a level, and man, she crushed this fall. And then in that race, here's the crazy thing. So first of all, she ran just with her chest puffed out, like she was going to do it the whole time, even though it's such a jump. But then on top of that, she fell 13 laps into the darn thing. I mean, hit the track. Her lip was bleeding. She had to run back up to the front pack. And these are the best women in the country. And she runs back up to the front pack and still runs 31:22 and beats Steph, who, you know, up to this point, I don't know if she'd ever beat Steph in a workout, hardly. So, I mean, it was just incredible. So that one sticks out from recent memory. And of course, you know, earlier in the year, the culmination of the whole group so far, which was when Alafine Tuimuk won the Olympic trials marathon. So that was enormous, but not only for Alafine, which was incredible. She's a great human being and deserved every ounce of that day, but it was a great day for the team. You know, our feeling going into that day was if one of us makes it, we all make it. And I really felt like that because everybody played such a huge role. You know, Steph finished sixth, Kellen finished eighth. We had three women in the top eight. It was a great day for our women. You know, Steph and Kellen were so gracious and so empathetic after the race, or actually, I should say Alafine was so empathetic toward them. They were so gracious toward her, crying after. I mean, they were just, it was just so great. And even the guys who didn't make it and didn't have the day they wanted for a couple of different reasons, some of which out of their control, you know, it wasn't like they sat in the tent and cried because they didn't make it. In fact, they couldn't wait to get to the finish line so they could see Alafine win. So that's the kind of team dynamic we had going by that time. And so I'm as happy about what occurred that day across the board as I am about Alafine's win.
Yeah, it was fun watching her actually. Back in college, I was coaching at Bradley, watching her roll around us again and again and again at Wichita State. I was like, shit, can we stop this anytime soon? Because, I mean, we're just competing for the trophy. But she was a talent. She was a sweet kid. She was an incredible kid. You know, one of the coaches there at Wichita State and Kirk Hunter, he was just like, yeah, she's just one good kid and we'll do whatever that you want to do. And, you know, heck, we're excited that she pulled off what she did. I think the one thing you keep talking about, which is incredible, is culture. And we expect to be able to have that like overnight, but it is great to actually hear your team talk about, hey, everybody, the guys, you know, that didn't finish or had some, again, something that happened out of their control. They all wanted to be there right away to make sure that they saw Alafine win and they wanted to congratulate her right away. That's a culture that, I mean, I think every single coach in the country strives for and hopes to have happen. But I think, again, you said it has to happen organically. You can't make it happen. You screwed up with some girls in the beginning, some kids, not girls, excuse me, some men and women, both probably on both sides that, you know, hey, I thought that was going to be a fit. It's not going to work. A year later, they're out. 2 years later, they're out. And you got to keep moving the parts. I mean, it's a testament to what you've done. So, I mean, honestly, before you keep moving on, congrats. That's incredible right there.
Yeah, thanks. We you know, a couple years back now, I guess maybe 2018, we sat down and had a meeting that lasted almost 6 hours, and we created our culture deck. So it's about 10 pages, little spiral bound deal. And all the words in there are basically out of their mouths. I mean, I kind of wrote it, you know, I took notes and put it together. But again, it wasn't us saying, hey, what do we want our culture to be? It was, what is our culture? How do we operate on a daily basis? How do we work out? How do we get ready for races? How do we approach races? How do we race? How do we handle ourselves in public? How do we handle ourselves on social media? It's just a complete comprehensive look at who we are. And I've used it in recruiting, and I think it's been valuable not only to get people excited, but actually weed people out. Like, if you read this and this isn't you, no problem. In fact, our last paragraph is, hey, we're not right for everyone. But if we are right and you do buy in, you will have success. It's 100%. We don't have anyone on the team who has fit and who has bought in and who has stayed here for multiple years who isn't thriving. And so that's really our pitch, is just, if you think this is the right place for you and it ends up being the right place, you're going to succeed.
Yeah. No question about it. Again, I'm impressed. That's very true. And to put that into the, essentially that you said the deck, and put it in the deck of cards. I mean, that's exactly what it is. If it doesn't work, get out, please leave. If you don't like whatever you're doing, I hate to say it, I've always been told this in my life. If there's something you don't like that you're doing, quit. Nobody's going to be upset with you. Go find something that actually inspires you. You've done that throughout your whole career that way. So one thing we've had some people on in the podcast before, we've had Brian Fetzer on a little bit. I know he started a deal with the American Track League. We've had the Pro Track series that's starting to start up and that kind of stuff. Is this something that, and I'm going to get to Marathon Project here in a second, but is this something that we're missing as a track and field community in the United States? Like, is this something that say like, hey, we need to make the sport more popular? You've got an incredible group with incredible culture. We look at some of the group, the way Tin Man is actually in the lead is starting to market themselves. We look at Boss Hart a little bit, that's starting to market themselves decently well, but groups that are starting to really pop up with some of the best athletes in the country. But unless you're on a podcast like this or track and field world a little bit, you really don't know who they are. And so the marketing thing is a huge deal. is a track and field series, in your opinion, something that we need, or is it something that we just need to market our teams better? Or how do we bring, honestly, how do we bring the general public or something like that back into a track and field meet?
It's multifaceted, of course. You need the teams, I think. You need the athletes doing a good job of branding themselves. You need the shoe companies that sponsor the athletes amplifying those messages, which we're fortunate that Hoka does for us. As far as the circuit, I'm really actually quite encouraged by the new circuit that was announced a few weeks ago, where Jesse Williams and his track meet, Blake Bolden and the you know, high performance meet he's going to have at Drake, Dave Milner, Music City, Max Parquette, Ed Murphy, and maybe I'm missing one and I'm sorry, but the circuit that they're forming is really encouraging to me, because I would like to see the days of the pros competing at the college meets. I would like to see those days be behind us. I don't find that to be a good business model. And I think what Jesse did in December and maybe what we did at the Marathon Project is a good example that a professional meet done correctly can be highly entertaining and valuable to sponsors. I mean, Jesse got a little bit of money here and there on very little time. And we did a good job at Marathon Project getting some good sponsorship dollars coming in 3 months, essentially. So imagine a whole year. Imagine what those guys are doing with a circuit and working together and getting a sponsor for the whole thing. There's a lot of value there, I think. And, you know, I'll just mention another event that I mentioned earlier, the Olympic trials. I mean, there were 250,000 people in Atlanta watching that race. That is significant. That is, Mike was there. That was a true sporting event that has every, that should have every track and field fan excited about the future, because ultimately, you look, you know, somebody could run an incredible performance, but if it's not entertaining and it's not put forth in an entertaining way, it really doesn't matter. You know, I think we get caught up in times and this and that, blah, blah, blah. But sports is entertainment, you know? And so to see the trials be so incredibly entertaining was very encouraging to me. And then, you know, again, not to toot our own horns for those of us who put on the Marathon Project, but it was entertaining. It was a huge success. And I'm just excited about what that might mean for the future.
Let's just jump into how the Marathon Project get going. I mean, you did an incredible job. No questions about it. I watched it. I enjoyed it. Everything about it. How do you come up with a 4.2 mile loop to sit down and say, yeah, we're going to run this, you know, 50 times. No, not 50 times, of course, but we're going to run this over and over again. We'll have some sweeping turnabouts to be able to go about it. The course looked great and it was fast. Absolutely. And that's, you said it in a couple of interviews and articles I read and listened to. They're like, it was going to produce fast times. And did it produce some fast times? Like, but how did this come about? Because I believe wasn't Josh part of this as well, Josh Cox?
Yeah. So Josh and I started working on together in the summer. And it was born out of necessity, of course, because of the pandemic and because we knew that all the fall races were canceled. And they had to be. You know, those are 40,000 person events. But I'm a sports fan. So I'm sitting there in the summer. I'm watching Premier League every weekend. I'm watching golf every weekend. I'm watching baseball every day. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute now. Something's not right here. If all those things can happen in a safe way with lots of, and the NBA, of course, and NHL, if all those things can happen, we're a professional sport too. And we can easily have a marathon, not easily, it was a lot of work, but we can put on a marathon with 100 people. You know, I'm in total agreement that we need to be canceling the 40,000 person events. We can have a professional only event. And so that was the idea. Then we brought Matt Helbig on, my former business partner who owns a race management company. And that was the kind of the team. And as far as the venue, we pretty early on kind of figured it had to be in Phoenix, because we thought about Southern California, but the guidelines are so much stricter there as it relates to the pandemic. So we settled on Phoenix area because of the weather in December and because of the proximity to me in Flagstaff. I can get down there in 2 hours, so I could go to the venue and scope it out. And we checked out the Phoenix Raceway, which is in a different part of the valley. And because we were thinking that a raceway would be the way to go, you know, kind of enclosed. Yep. You've got this loop, you know, but the Phoenix Raceway is an oval. And so it's got a bank. It was no good. I went down there. I checked it out. I checked out the parking lot. It has an enormous parking lot, but it wasn't well kept. And it just, it wasn't going to be good. It wasn't going to be right. It just didn't feel right. And so we were kind of back to the drawing board. Then there was a motorsports park at the venue we ended up choosing. And it's more of a Formula One type of deal. So flat road. So we thought about using the motorsports park. But when Matt looked at the overhead, the Google image, he said, well, what about this road? Look at this road. Why do we need to go in the motorsports park? So when I went down there to visit, I essentially had the guy in charge just take me on his little golf cart and just take me on that loop. And sure enough, I was literally on the golf cart calling Matt and Josh saying, this is it. This is the place. This is it. We're either doing it here or we're not doing it because this is the best place we could possibly find. The roads were so smooth. I mean, they're so flat and well-kept. It was like the Berlin course. And oh, yeah. So that's how we found the venue. They were great to work with, the Rawhide Event Center down there. And yeah, then it just became a matter of creating all the logistics and protocols that we needed to do and getting the athletes and blah, 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 blah. But it worked out.
Like yada, yada, yada. Oh yeah. By the way, we just put this thing on, you know, prize money. You guys even had that too. Who put that on? Who put that up? If I can ask,
we ended up, I mean, we always wanted to have prize money, but yeah. You know, and I think we did a good job of explaining this along the way, and maybe it was eye-opening for people. We knew, because Josh and I work with these kind of athletes, that as long as they ran fast, they were going to get paid. They were going to make money off of their sponsorships because all of those high-level folks have really nice bonus schedules based on a number of different things, but time is always on there. And so we knew if guys were running on 210 and women were running under 225 or 226, they were going to make a lot of money. So that was kind of our pitch to them. And of course, they all did it because there was nothing else. There's no other choice, but we didn't want to screw them. I mean, I would have given a bigger prize purse if we could have feasibly made it happen, but we had Brooks come on board in a big way. We had Jay Bird headphones come on. We had Picky Bars and we had Roll Recovery. So we got cash from all those companies. Brooks was the big one. I'm just going to say they were wonderful. I of course have to be careful because that's not my company, but it was a totally different thing. And honestly, Hoka was great about it as they always are. And actually I had nothing to do with the sponsorships, which I told Josh from the beginning. I said, look, this is a weird spot for me. So I cannot have anything to do with the sponsorship. So that was all Josh. He did a wonderful job. And then, what's it called? USATF came through. Now they wanted to stay behind the scenes. They didn't give us cash, but they took care of the partnership in terms of the broadcast. Okay, so again, I don't know how much they want me to say, but we didn't have to do anything from the broadcast perspective. They took that all on, including the NBC broadcast and including the drug testing. So they did take care of a lot, which was great. And, you know, they deserve credit. I don't know how much credit they want, but they did a great job and credit where credit is due. You know, I know they catch a lot of flack and I've certainly, criticized them for various things over the years, but I also tried to again give credit where credit is due, and they came through.
No, absolutely.
Ben, could you talk about the broadcast a little bit? It seemed like there was a lot of positive reviews on the broadcast between the split screen and the announcers were great, you know. But could you talk a little bit more about the process of setting that up and the just the execution of everything?
Yeah, I will talk about that because I know that's a sore subject for some people. They just think it's crazy that you have to pay for a webcast. And, you know, guys, here's the deal. I get it, man. You know, it seems like a lot, $12.99 a month or whatever it is for Runner Space, but you got to understand that everything you watch on television costs money. And it's up to the consumer to decide how they want to spend their money. I get that. And if you don't want to spend the money on Runner Space, I get that. I got no problem with that. But to demand it to be free really doesn't make sense to me if you stop and think about it. What do you guys watch for free? If you're watching it on NBCSN, you're paying for cable or DirecTV or YouTube TV. If you watch it on ESPN, same thing, right? If you watch it on Fox Sports 1, same thing, right? The only sports that are, I guess, free are the ones that are shown on CBS, ABC, or NBC or Fox on a Saturday or Sunday. We're talking about football. We're talking about, you know, high-level golf, a couple other things, the World Series. I mean, there's not much. Even most of the playoffs now are on cable. But guess what? What do they say about media, right? If you're not paying for the product, you are the product. So if you're watching it on CBS or wherever, you're getting ads shown at you every minute. You know, the bottom line is you gotta pay to watch sports. That's just how it goes, like it or not. And again, have your issues with the cost, have your issues with the subscription model. It's fine. But these things cost money. And Mike, what I would tell you is, again, when you're on the inside of it, you see how much work goes into the broadcast. You can't expect that to be free. They're flying people in from all over the country. There's unbelievable equipment. There's motorcycles that they're renting. There's cars that they're renting. They're doing an incredible job, and the broadcast was really well done, and it costs money. And the other thing I'd tell you that I think people don't realize is I got a couple of texts. Oh, you know, somebody texts me, oh, you should get $5 from, you know, every viewer from NBC. I'm like, I don't think you get it, man. Like, we have to pay them. When you see our sport on TV, we paid for it. Yeah, like track and field on TV, that time is bought. And then you only can make money on it if you're able to sell the commercials. Same thing with, like, I hear people, oh, cornhole's on TV. Why aren't we on TV? Cornhole paid to be on TV, friends. ESPN's not paying cornhole, okay? Like, this may come as a shock to some people, but these kind of sports, you pay for the time, and then you sell the sponsorships to advertisers. It's only the footballs and the baseballs and the golfs and the soccers that and college basketball and college football and whatnot that get these big multi-million dollar deals. So maybe that's a bit of information that people didn't know. But anyway, we were able to sell commercials during that NBC broadcast, and that's why we were able to get the Brookses and the Jaybirds and the Picky Bars, et cetera, Roll Recovery. So did that answer your question, Mike?
Yeah, you know, and another follow-up to that is, do you feel like our sport, with its beginnings in amateurism, play a part in people thinking that everything should be free? You know, I shouldn't have to pay to get into this track meet. I shouldn't have to pay to get into this cross-country meet. I shouldn't have to pay to watch this meet on TV. But yet, every other sport, you know, it's $100 to go to an NFL game. Yeah. And, you know, to go to an NBA game, you know, and obviously you're paying cable and streaming services to watch these games. And we're totally okay with that. But the minute the sport that we love asks for $10, we're going to throw a fit, right?
Well, I think that, yes, we're steeped in amateurism. You know, we made a huge mistake in the 60s when tennis and golf went professional, and we decided to stay amateur, and we've been paying for that mistake ever since. Now, I think we can get away from it. You know, I still have optimism there. But yeah, we're so far behind. I mean, we're so incredibly far behind. And we try to do everything ourselves. You know, the other thing that golf and tennis did, kind of because one guy came in and did it himself, but a guy named Mark McCormick, who was an agent essentially. So he was an attorney, but he got into sports and he started representing Arnold Palmer, and he started looking at these contracts and the way things were going in that sport. And he was like, "What, Arnold Palmer? What do you mean they're just giving you clubs? They're not paying you? There's thousands of people buying these clubs every day because you're playing with them. They need to be paying you." And it's essentially like the same thing that goes on in our sport now today. This is the 1960s. Mark McCormick figured this out with golf, and then he did it with tennis. And then he built this agency, IMG, and they bought the rights to Wimbledon, and they bought the rights to the British Open, and they turned them from golf tournaments and tennis tournaments into entertainment properties, right? And so that's why you see like Rolex on the side of the Wimbledon courts, you know, and like they think of everything, right? And my point is, that's because that's what they know how to do. We try to do all these things ourselves. For example, you know, if the Marathon Project were to continue, I don't know, that's a long ways off, and I got to talk to Matt and Josh and all these things, but I would want a company like IMG or Wasserman or CAA, one of these agencies that put on these golf tournaments, tennis tournaments, et cetera, I would want them to take it on. Why would we continue to? I love Josh, but he can't make the same phone calls that those folks can make. And if they can turn a profit, let's say at the Indian Wells tennis tournament in Florida every year, which is one of the, you know, kind of lower level tournaments, then we can sure as heck do it. You know, again, we had 250,000 people at the trials. The sport is healthy from a fan standpoint. We just have to treat it like entertainment and like a business.
Sport is healthy from a fan standpoint, but we still struggle to get any fans at a collegiate track and field meet. You know, it's hard for
you guys can figure that out. That's not my bag.
I figured you're gonna throw that back at me. I was like, it's great.
I can't solve all your problems, man.
I was hoping you could solve one of them at least. I mean, come on, solve the problem. Let's go.
But you know what? What I would say is that that could indirectly affect you in the long term if we can't keep college track and field healthy, because you know college track and field is juicing Olympians and those potential athletes that can move on and be pros. So.
You know, no, I love college track and field.
Situation that we have to figure out.
Yeah, for sure. Here's the one thing I would say about college track and field is I just don't understand the participatory nature of it. I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, Mike Krzyzewski doesn't have to put in the 12th guy on his bench. I mean, he, you know, I don't understand why we have to have every single person competing all the time. I don't understand why the meets have to take 12 hours. They're not entertaining. I don't enjoy them. And I'm in the sport and I don't enjoy them. I remember talking to Mike last year at BU. I was like, how long do you have to be here today? He's like, 12 hours. I said, 12 hours. Good God. That's torture. I mean, that is torture. You know, look, I think some meets should be like that, but the high level meets should be entertaining. They should be 2 hours long, bang, 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 top heats only. And that's it. I mean, you would never go to a college D1 basketball game, get through 10 minutes, and then have to watch shitty people play for the next 10 minutes, and then watch some good people play for 5 minutes, and then watch crappy people play again for a bit. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm not trying to be rude. I just don't get it from an entertainment perspective.
No, you're 100% right. I think we're all in agreement here.
Yeah,
I think we're all in agreement.
We've had this conversation a million times, and I've said it before. You know what I mean? The fact that we, you know, have to find a place for the number 4 and 5 people on your roster to have just opportunities. And I think Mike kind of hit the nail on the head. This participatory nature of our sport, and it starts early, and the participatory and the inexpensive nature of our sport. One of the great things about track and field is that where else can an 8 or 9 or 10 year old have an opportunity to go and play a sport on a regular basis, be part of a team and have that kind of culture for pretty inexpensive, you know, if you're playing tennis or basketball or softball or volleyball, that's big, big money that you got to pay. But at some place, and it's good to hear somebody that's in this professional realm that understands the business nature of this. And maybe once these circuits and things, if they, you know, that we're hearing about start to happen, do happen, maybe in time that stuff starts to trickle down a little bit, because what I'm hearing is, you know, that's not your bag, and that you're 100% right. I agree with that. You shouldn't be concerned with that. You've got your own business to run, but eventually that business is going to depend on somebody feeding you people, right? And if that business thrives and that is healthy, then I'm curious of your opinion, might that not trickle down? And you know what I mean? Like the NFL is nothing without college football, right? Like they're not going to be able to do what they do without college football. And perhaps if we were able to create an entertaining, you know, entity that trickles down and then increases some of the competitiveness and motivation and potentially, you know, value to some of these collegiate type programs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the circuit gets going, like I think it will, and all we have to do then is just, you know, cause I think a lot of times people try to reinvent the wheel. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, we just need to do what's working in other sports, or like you say, if the circuit works, then take that same model and apply it to some of the college meets and, you know, have these 2 hour super fun, super entertaining events that are based on the idea that it is in fact an entertainment property, just like college football and just like college basketball. And I don't expect it to bring in the same money. I don't think any of us are that naive, but I do believe that, again, from a fan standpoint, look at the NCAA cross country championships, for example. That is an entertaining day. I mean, that is fun. And people come from all over the country and they fly and they drive and they watch it on television or on the web or wherever it's being shown. And it's an enormously exciting event. I would argue that I could pluck a Joe sports fan off the street with a beer belly and bring him to Terre Haute or to Louisville or wherever and say, hey, check this out. And I guarantee you he would have a good time at the NCAA cross country championships. Now, he might fall asleep at some of these 12-hour track meets, but he would have fun at the NCAA cross country championships. And if we could bring that entertainment that we know is possible to track meets and to other cross country meets. Why not? What are we waiting for? Let's do it. I think we know how to do it. We're just not doing it.
One of the things I think we see in entertainment and other sports is rivalries between professional groups. How do you kind of create your brand, or how do you see the future going if these circuits do take off, creating maybe rivalries between various groups?
Yeah, I think among the hardcore fans, that's already happening for sure. I think people have their favorites, you know. Some people love our team. Some people love the Bowerman team. Some people love the 10-man team, whatever it might be. And, of course, there's a crossover and people like all the groups and whatnot. But I do think that folks have their favorites, and I think that's happening organically for sure. You know, could it be could that process be accelerated by these circuits? Yeah, maybe. Because I think the other thing that we need to do is, and it's kind of elitist, but we got to stop, even in the pro world, you know, having these second heats, third heats, these people that, you know, they claim they're professionals, but they're not really. And they're just slowing down the action, and they're slowing down and they're kind of diluting what it means to be a professional athlete as well. This is one of the, we talked about, we've nitpicked college stuff. I'll nitpick a pro thing. Like, I mean, you got these folks who, you know, they're putting all this stuff out on social media. Oh, I'm sponsored by, you know, company X. No, you're not, man. They're giving you free socks. You know, you're not a professional athlete, you know, and you're only a professional athlete if that's your job, if you're getting paid and that's at least your main source of income, if you're not your only source of income. And so that kind of hurts us too, back to Mike's point about amateurism, because there's really no structure to professional running in terms of there's no umbrella organization. There's no NFL, NHL, MLB, right? And there's not even the things you have in cycling and triathlon, where you have to get your pro card, et cetera. Anybody, I mean, you see people on Facebook, you know, they're GoFundMe. I'm trying to make the Olympics. He's like a 220 guy, 220 marathoner, you know, and tell his friends and family he's trying to make the Olympics. So there's no, I think we need to balance the idea that we're relatable to everyone, which is great. Like to Matt's point about, or to your point about how inexpensive it is and how available it is to everyone. And that's great. And we should be relatable to 4-hour marathoners, 5-hour marathoners. Absolutely. But we should also kind of put these people on a bit more of a pedestal, because they are pretty dang amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, Sarah Hall ran 220 at the Marathon Project. That is not like running a 4-hour marathon. It's not. It's very different. And so, you know, I think, again, we got to balance being relatable to the everyday runner, but also not be afraid to kind of hype up how amazing these people are.
Ben, what's this kind of different direction here? What's a day look like for you? You know what I mean? I could look at all these other guys and, you know, I kind of got a basic idea of in the collegiate world, you know, the different administrative things and top of the coaching things and that sort of stuff, recruiting, whatnot. What's your day look like? I'm really curious I'd imagine it's fairly different.
Yeah, it probably is different. I get up, go to practice. We practice in the morning, come back, shower up, go to the office. At the office, I'm usually, so I'm the head coach, but I'm also the executive director. So all the tweets, all the Facebook posts, all the Instagram posts, that's all me. I write the e-newsletter every week. Of course, I'm working on their schedules every week. I go to strength and conditioning. We have that twice a week. I do drills and strides in the afternoons twice a week. But I'm also the one that's sort of, you know, communicating with people inside the industry about, you know, race directors at the major marathons or the track meets that we go to, things like that. Talking to the various agents, making sure the athletes are happy, getting everything they need. You know, I work with my wife, Jen, on the relationship with Hoka and the relationship with Rudy Project, one of our other sponsors, and Final Surge. And I don't know, man, the days just kind of fill up, you know, they just kind of fill up with stuff.
That sounds a lot. Yeah. And a lot of stuff.
And we're always doing, you know, we're very big on content. So trying to be calculated about when we release things, you know, for example, this week we signed Ryan Hill. And so, you know, instead of just one tweet, hey, we signed Ryan Hill, you know, we got the press release ready. We got the pictures ready. I talked to Let's Run. I gave them the exclusive so they could go first. And then once they put it up, then I sent it out to all the other running outlets. And, you know, we had nice pictures ready to go. And then our Hoka PR team reached out to some podcast folks. So Ryan's going to be on some podcasts next week. And, you know, all those things take time. You know, what I don't have to do is some of the bureaucratic stuff that you guys have to do. So sorry about that. So I'm free to do whatever I want. But I spend that time trying to build the brand.
Ben, what about, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier about recruiting, you know, new athletes to your program. Like how much time do you actually spend combing through, you know, the cross country results, the national championship, to maybe pinpoint who you want to go after, you know, to sign to your group?
That's another one that's easier than you guys. Because you're only looking for the very top people. So I only have to go about 10 deep, which is nice. Yeah, I mean, I keep an eye on it, you know, I keep an eye on it. And then when it starts getting close, if we have a roster spot open, you know, I'll talk to the coach first. And I feel like that's the best thing to do. So I would, you know, talk to one of you guys and just say, hey, you know, we're kind of interested in so-and-so, but I don't want to step on any toes. Cause sometimes they like to stay with their college coach. That kind of happens less and less now, but nonetheless, I kind of put that out there. And then from there, if the coach is cool with it, you know, I'll talk to the athlete. And then if the athlete signs with an agent, then, you know, start talking to the agent, bring the athlete in for a visit, make sure it's a good fit, you know, let them digest the visit a little bit. And then, you know, if we think it's going to be a match, then we talk to Hoka about making an offer financially. So that's sort of the process.
You know, I was going to kind of follow up a little bit because, and maybe to educate not only myself, but just the whole running community. You know, I kind of think I know where this is going to go, but you're kind of modeling this more like the St. Louis Cardinals than the traditional, you know, post-grad, you know, or post-collegiate goes out and gets a contract type deal. Like you have, I mean, it's a team structure from the top down. Is that correct? Or is it, am I wrong? Or I mean, it is a little bit different than what had been going on in the sport for year after year after year. I mean, this is a new idea. Relatively.
Well, I think other people are doing a good job too, so I can't speak to that. But what we do is, you know, we're trying to, our roster is a puzzle, right? And we're trying to put the right pieces in there. And for example, Ryan signing, because it was the most recent. You know, on the guy side right now, if you look at our roster, we've got Matt Baxter in his 20s, Rory Linkletter in his 20s, Tyler Day, very young, you know, all those guys are in their mid-20s, basically, you know, Nick Hogger, same thing, Sid Vaughn is in his 20s. So we've got all these young guys, and then we got Scott Fall, who's 29, we got Scott Smith in his 30s. But, you know, to me, it felt like we needed another veteran. A veteran presence as opposed to a kid right out of college, right? We've already got a lot of them right now. We also have a lot of marathoners right now. So it made sense, I think, to get somebody with a little more speed in his legs, right? Like Ryan, whereas on the women's side, that was kind of the case last year. And that's why we brought in Lauren Paquette, 5,000 meter runner. And she ran great with us last year. But now on the women's side, all of a sudden, now we have Lauren and Steph and Kellen and Alphine, and they're kind of veterans. So my guess is our next signing on the women's side will be someone straight out of the NCAA that we think would fit into our culture and has a lot of versatility, I think, and kind of could compete at 5,000, 10,000, eventually farther, half marathon, marathon. So, yeah, I'm not just grabbing anybody I can get. I'm making conscious decisions about who's going to fit in our program. Are we the right program for them? Do they respond to the same kind of training that we do? Cause we're not going to have 12 different workouts going on. You know, our idea is this is a group and we're going to feed off of one another. So I want to make sure that physically it's going to be a fit. And then of course, from a chemistry perspective, you know, are they going to get along with everybody? Are they going to make us better? And are we going to make them better? So yeah, John, I'm thinking about all those things and, you know, again, now we're in a position where we could be picky. And I think I said this to Mike McManus, our global sports marketing. This is exactly what I said to him the other day. I said, when you can be picky, you should be picky. So that's kind of our philosophy.
Ben, you've, you know, been involved in so many things, you know, from early on starting a business, you know, running shoe company and, you know, the marathon project to what you're doing now. Looking back, are there things that you wish you would have done differently or, you know, maybe, you know, handled differently or would have made things easier down the road?
Well, you know, we all have our regrets from our 20s, right? But that's personal stuff. That's personal. I've been staying with
you. I remember those.
I assume you're talking business. Business wise, you know, I burnt myself out at the stores. That was dumb. But then again, I don't know that I would have done it differently because we kind of had to do it. You had to hustle. You know, there was no choice. And desperation is an incredible motivator. So, you know, I think anyway that I learned from that, and I think I do a little bit better job now. I still have that same sort of mindset, but I try to back off here and there. You know, like I said earlier, I probably just would have taken more time off after I left the stores and just really tried to veg out for a while and let myself relax. I don't think I felt like myself for almost a whole year really after leaving. But I don't have many regrets, really. I've kind of always just let my gut drive my decision-making. And, you know, I have a wonderful wife who's been by my side the whole time and been on board with all my crazy ideas. And she's organized, so that's helpful. Yeah, you know, and I think when it comes to my running career, too, which I don't talk about much, but, it, you know, the thing about my running career, and this is what I tell the athletes, too, is, like, aren't we just all trying to find out how good we can be? That's ultimately what all these folks that you work with are really trying to do. I think we get too caught up in, I want to run this time. I want to go to regionals. I want to go to nationals. These things are all arbitrary. We're really just trying to find out how good we can be. And I am proud of that in the sense that I pretty much found that out. Now, the answer wasn't what I wanted because I wasn't that good, but at least I found out, you know, and I am proud that I went to Hanson's and spent those 2 years there. And that's what I was ultimately getting at is that I do like that there are these opportunities for these athletes to run post-collegiately, because I think a lot of people don't quite have that answer yet. When they finish college, they haven't quite answered it, nor really should they have. They're only 22. And they want to answer that question, you know? So it's cool that there's opportunities now. And again, even though I left with $7 in my pocket after 2 years, I still think those were a great 2 years and I would do them again.
Has that mantra, how good can I be, changed in your professional capacity?
It's something I've passed on to the athletes, you know, and we really take that on now. I mean, we screwed up, you know, early on. I mean, I did the thing where, you know, I go up to the whiteboard. Oh, we want to run this time and this time and we want to do this thing and this thing. It's all bullshit, you know, because that sets you up for failure. And it starts to attach your self-worth to these arbitrary things, some of which you can't control. Like, how can your goal in life be to finish in the top three at some meet when all you can control is you? You know, sometimes people beat you and you got to tip your cap, you know? And so when we started kind of just trying to figure out how good we can be, that's when we started having our best success. And I've told this story many times, but this is the honest to God truth. When Scott Faubel ran 209.09 at the Boston Marathon, he and I never talked about what his time was going to be at that race. Zero times the entire segment. Our goal, the whole segment was, let's get as fit as we can be so we can run up front. That's all we cared about. And he went out. I didn't know he was going to run 209. He said he didn't even know that until a mile to go. He looked at his watch and said, oh, man, if I run 450 here, I might break 209. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And it's just so freeing. It's so freeing to stop worrying about splits every 2 seconds. You know, same thing with Danny. I said she ran 31:22. Yeah, she wanted to run under 31:25. But I told her before the race, do not listen to the splits. Do not worry about the splits. It's so rigid, right? Looking over and trying to listen to the split every lap is so, it's so sucking. It's such an energy suck. And I told her too, I'm not even going to tell you. I said, I might say something late. And I remember with a mile to go, I said, sub five and you got it. That's all I said, you know, the whole time about splits. And so that's kind of a thing we've taken on as a group. And, you know, same at the Olympic trials. We just wanted to win, man. We just want to try to win. You know, we weren't worried about splits or what the first half was going to be or blah, blah, blah. We just wanted to race, you know.
I love that.
How I know do you guys have to worry training about splits for various reasons with qualifying and whatnot. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm curious how you manage that in training, you know, getting their headspace out of the times and the splits and everything.
Great question.
Yeah, it is a good question because actually we're pretty structured in training, but it's because we want to perform our best on the big day, you know? And so we can't race in practice all the time. Now, we'll work very hard sometimes, and sometimes we will have a little less structure, but a lot of the way we view practice is practice. You know, just it's the same reason you do layup after layup after layup or free throw after free throw after free throw. It's because it's practice. And so in our training, you know, the reason we're doing 20 by 600 or 20 by a K or 15 by a mile is so that we can master running fast and relaxed and just master it, right? And then again, it's the same reason that occasionally we'll do an all-out 5K at the end of after 12 by a K. Or whatever it might be, so that we can remember how much this darn thing hurts. Because if all you do is smooth, 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 then you get to that real tough part and you don't know what the heck to do because you never felt this before. So, but again, it's because we're practicing what we want to accomplish on race day. And so that's kind of the reason our practices are so structured and yet our races are so unstructured is because that's what I think both of those things require to succeed.
You're right. A lot of what we do is split, split, split. And it's hard because we've got the 18-year-old kid, that's 17-year-old kid, that's all their high school coach got them. That's all. You got to make sure this splits here. And you got to make sure you're 26-3 at the 200. You got to make sure you're, you know, 72 through the quarter. And so that's all it is. The kid comes in. Oh, I can't run fast. Why can't you run fast? Oh, I don't know what my splits are. Did you forget what a feel is? You know, I was just having this talk yesterday with some people from Garmin. And I said, you know, I love your watch. I think it's great. I think it everything you do about the watch is great, but it screws with our sport because the actual feel of running is out the window. And I ran right around the time you did in college as well. And we never had that. We had the Nike Tri-X 300 and all it gave you was a split and that was it. And it was the greatest watch I ever had in my life. And I loved it. So yeah, we're a lot more rigid today.
Well, I think too, like when you talk about the difference between college athletes and professionals, you know, a lot of college athletes are more concerned about what's going to go on social media and how they appear, while professionals are, this is their livelihood. So they understand that race day is payday and day is going to keep food on their table. And I think it's maybe a little bit easier at that point to discern the importance of structured practice and race day. While in college, it's kind of, you know, I'm not saying all collegiate athletes are like that, obviously not, but I think it's just a little bit different because there's less at stake, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of variables. Plus, once they've gotten to us, you know, a lot of the people who can't handle it have already been weeded out, you know? So, I mean, yeah, it's a way bigger challenge for you guys. But I just would say that, you know, and I kind of want to go back for a second, too, because I don't want to sound like a dick. I'm all for the fact that we're giving an opportunity to all these athletes in college. And the beauty of it is, there is an opportunity for an athlete of almost any level collegiately, right?
Yes.
When you were talking about the business side of it, I'm talking about at the very highest level. I'm not talking about doing away with anybody who's not great. That's not what I'm saying. I was talking about the business. So anyway, just to clarify, but on this topic, like to go to an athlete on a regular kind of mid-level D1 team, let's say it's a female who wants to run, I don't know, 17 minutes, okay, for 5K. Okay. I would say that, you know, like, okay, imagine she goes out and runs a great race and with a lap to go, she's got it in the bag. And she just basically shuts it down. 3-4 people pass her in the last lap, but she runs 16:59. Should she be proud of that effort? Or should she be more proud if with a lap to go, it was tight and she kicked like she's never kicked before and she passed 3 or 4 people and she ran 17:01. I'll take the 17:01. You know what I mean? But we've been so conditioned to base everything, including our self-worth, on these times. And I just think, maybe we should try at the collegiate level and the high school level to begin to analyze our races in a different way. Again, for example, like a football team, when they win or lose, they still look at the tape and they still look at the things they did well and the things they didn't do well. Whereas I feel like in our sport, it's a lot of black and white. Either I ran under 17 or I didn't. So either it was a terrible failure or it was a huge success. And I just don't think it's like that.
And here's a quick question to go use that same example. which would you, let's say you knew nothing about track and field, right? Which would you rather watch?
And I don't know anything about track and field except distance running.
Well, you know, my point being, you know what I mean? Would you rather watch the girl that goes, or the woman that goes and pass, you know, has a gutsy last lap, passes three or four women and runs 17:01, or would you want to watch somebody that maybe it was a great race for her, but she shuts it down and gets passed by three people? You 100%
the 17:01. What would 17 minutes mean to me?
That's my point, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? And so it's kind of a two-pronged, you know, benefit to that, right? Like, and to sort of be able to create more opportunities where the value is the win and the loss and the effort, and not just a mark, right? Because the average person sitting in the stands has no idea what that mark is anyway. They don't care, but they want to see people battling. You know what I mean? They want to see drama. They want to see, you know, that kind of effort in a race. So I think that there's more to that than just, you know, what it means for that particular kid. You know what I mean? Like, that's a far more exciting, marketable thing.
Hey Ben, in terms of the professional coaching game, you know, as we have talked to some of our athletes who are interested in becoming a college coach, right? And there's somewhat of a path to becoming a college coach, right? Maybe it's probably run in college and then be a graduate assistant or a volunteer coach and kind of put in your dues and work your way up. But if there was a young person listening to this podcast and they said, yeah, I really want to do what Ben does, I'd like to be a professional coach, you know, what advice would you give to that kind of person? Because it does seem like an enigma out there. Like, how in the world does someone become a professional running coach and actually make a living doing it?
Yeah, it's hard because there's not that many spots, you know? I mean, there's just not, right? So, It's not a very viable career path because there's only so many spots, but you know, maybe those spots are growing. We just hired a full-time assistant. We're going to announce her on maybe next week sometime. I'm not exactly sure, but we're really excited about it. So we have created a job that did not exist before, which I'm very happy about. You know, Jerry Schumacher has a couple of assistants. Pete Ray at Zap has an assistant. Kevin and Keith have at different times had people working with them at the Hansen's program. So there are a few jobs. You know, I think I if I were advising someone going into the coaching profession, I would advise them to be open-minded, but also kind of make a decision about, if not pro, at least decide, do you want to work with super high level athletes, or do you want to work at a more of a mid-level program or a D2 or D3 program, which is totally fine. Like, these are all different things, but kind of figure it out, because if you want to work with high level athletes, you kind of have to go to that. You kind of have to weasel your way into that level from the get-go. I think you guys probably know that. You have to be a grad assistant and work for nothing at Syracuse or Stanford or Oregon or Wisconsin or Stanford or NAU or whatever. Because if you start at these lower levels, you kind of get stuck, and I don't think you should, but that's just what happens. And if your goal is to work with high level athletes, maybe even pros, it's going to be hard to jump to the professional level if you don't have some of those things on your resume. It stinks. You know? I wish it wasn't like that. In fact, we had our coaching search was this past fall, summer into fall, and we had over 80 applicants, and I wanted to be really open-minded, and I was, and I moved high school coaches on to the next level and different people with different resumes and backgrounds. And, you know, but at the end of the day, we ended up going with a D1 Power 5 coach, you know, I mean, because this person had experience that these others didn't with super high level athletes. And so, yeah, I don't know that there's a direct path to professional coaching, but the quickest one would be to work with the highest level people possible as soon as possible.
I mean, that makes sense, honestly. If you look at the pro world or the basketball world, I mean, who's getting those jobs to jump up from the NCAA to the pros, to the NBA? Or if you go from the college ranks, or, you know, if we're going from football to the NFL, who's getting those calls? it's not the guy to conference, you know, sorry, Conference USA, but it's not the Conference USA schools or the, I'm going to try and have football whack schools. It's the ones at the SECs and the power schools and doing that kind of stuff. You're welcome. But you're kind of doing that stuff to jump up just to make sure, because, I mean, they're winning national titles, jumping up and down. They're doing a great job with all that kind of stuff. Where do you see the direction of track and field in the U.S.?
Like I said, I think it's healthy. I think we're heading in the right direction. I think that we're starting to understand that USATF is a governing body, and we're not supposed to look to them for all the answers. They are akin to U.S. soccer. They are akin to USA basketball. They are not the NBA. They're not supposed to be. So let's stop complaining about USATF. Because they're actually doing what they're supposed to do. And let's work together, the people who are in the positions of power, the gatekeepers, if you will, let's work together to turn this thing into a business, into an entertainment entity. And I think those things are happening. So my feeling right now is pretty optimistic, actually.
Ben, I'll ask a controversial question.
Here we go. Yep.
At some point.
Okay. Isn't that what we've been doing the whole time, John?
Now, this I think might go over the top here. At some point, and I'm not saying in the next, 4 years, down the road, 15, 20, 25 years, do you think the sport needs to get away from the Olympic model?
Oh, that is a good question. Yes. That doesn't mean I think we should not be in the Olympics. But the Olympic sport moniker is a death sentence. I mean, it's not where you want to be. Go on ESPN.com, try to find Olympic sports. You got to go here and then this other drop down and then this other drop down. And there it is very much at the bottom. And it's lumped in with all these other things. Yeah, it's not good. You know, it's not good. And we're getting there, right? Like in some ways, the marathon, for example, I would argue, and this is someone who coaches these kind of athletes, I'm not so sure I wouldn't rather win Boston or New York than an Olympic medal. There's a controversial answer for you, but like we're getting there in the marathon. So we know it's possible, right? We're not there in track and field though. And so we got a long ways to go, but at least we have a model that's kind of working in the marathon where Boston and New York and London and Berlin have become these giant entities and these enormous world famous events. Certainly it's possible, right? It's happened in the other sports. So I think we can do it. But yes, I think we need to get away from the Olympics being the pinnacle of our sport. I don't think we need to get away from the Olympics, but we need to get away from that being the pinnacle.
No, and I would agree with that because, I watch, obviously the Rio games and the added golf, which to me is like the craziest thing. Like, do you think these professional golfers really care if they win the Olympic, an Olympic gold medal? No, they want to win.
Matt Kuchar went to the Olympics and didn't know if it was a singles tournament or if it was a team thing.
Yeah.
He asked a week before.
Yeah. They're more concerned about the majors. I mean, why would you be concerned about that? And it's like the same in soccer, like the men's soccer tournament, the Olympics, it's U23. It's not the best of the best. The World Cup is for that. And so I do think, I think long-term track and field needs to get away from, again, yes, we still run the Olympics. It's still an honor to compete for your country and do those things.
Absolutely.
If you want it to be viable and make a lot of money, you got to get away from the Olympic model.
100% agree.
Man. So let's come back to, and I love that. I agree with that. Cause with the Olympic model, the amateurism is something that's right now hurting collegiate track and field. It's killing us on a weekly basis on a every single meet basis. What's something you're excited about for your team? I know you got a new coach coming out. We can't see who that is. We won't say anything about that. You just added Ryan Hill. What are you excited about for the years to come a little bit, especially if COVID, well, heck, you can do amazing things if COVID doesn't break, although we pray it does break here pretty quickly. What are you excited about for the team?
I'm kind of a short-term guy. Of course, I want to be doing this for the long term, but I'm very excited about this year. I think that we're going to go into the trials with a real chance to make the team at all four of the distance events. So, we'll have Ryan in the 5,000, we'll have Tyler in the 10,000, as well as a couple other guys. But right now, Tyler looks like the guy that has a real chance to make the team. And then we'll go into the women's 10,000 with three people that already have the standard. And we'll go into the 5,000 with Lauren Paquette, who has a killer kick. And if she can get a little stronger, I think she'll be there. So I'm very excited for Eugene. And even though I talked about not making arbitrary things the goal. Of course we want to make the team, you know, but you know, I think we can. So I think that, you know, that should be something we shoot for. And actually, you know, I kind of want to take the same approach we took to the trials marathon, which is, I hate that make the team. It's basically you saying, well, I hope I can get third, you know, like we want to win. You know, I would love to win. The people that get second and third are the people that tried to win. The people that get fourth, fifth, and sixth are the people that tried to make the team. So, you know, we're going to go in there, try to win those races. And I'm excited about that. And of course I'm excited about Alphine running at the Olympic Games. That's going to be amazing. And I don't know that I'm thinking too much past that.
You have a busy year coming up in front of you. There's no questions about that. And it's exciting. I'm excited to hear about it. I'm excited to watch it. I'm excited to follow it, be a fan of it, and see what you do. So keep rocking and rolling. Ben, it was an absolute pleasure to have you here on the podcast. We truly appreciate you spending time. I think, not only from just a coaching standpoint, but also from a, from a culture standpoint and from a professional standpoint, I think you shed some light on some things that we don't think about a little bit, especially from the TV aspect of it. Hey, you've got to pay to be on TV. I think people forget about the fact you have to pay to be on TV, and then there's another way to do it. So I'm hoping some people that listen to it that don't want to pay for it will sit down and turn around and pay for it. But truly, thank you for being on here. We really had a joy. It was a joy having you.
Thanks. Sorry I talked so much and you guys just had to listen, but I did have a good time. Thank you for having me.
No, I think that's fine. So ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Thanks for making this one of the top running podcasts in the country. We truly appreciate it. We're glad we're back. We're glad the new year is rocking and rolling for everybody. Stay safe, be smart, and we will absolutely talk to you again next week and try and do better. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Absolutely thank you for joining us here on the Off Track podcast. It was incredible to have everybody here. Amanda, what do we learn a lot about from Ben Rosario? Not only the culture is something that makes a huge difference, that roster is a puzzle when he goes ahead and puts it together. But also, I think as a pro coach, you have to realize, like, hey, there's a lot more things that go into it than just the writing workouts, and he does an incredible job with it. So we've learned an absolute ton. I know all the guys did. And one other thing to not forget about, when you're going to go ahead and subscribe to a TV service or something to go ahead to watch a pro meet, you're actually helping those guys make some money and make things happen in our professional world. So please go ahead and subscribe to that stuff. But thank you, as always, for making us one of the top running podcasts in the country. We try and strive every week to do better and better for everybody. We're on Instagram. We're on social. We're on Twitter. The Off Track podcast is where you're going to find us. If you like it, please retweet us. Please comment on us, send an email, send us a link, tell us something we should sit down and talk about, because this is something that we love to do. And excitingly enough, in the next few weeks, we'll tell you for the first time, unless you saw it on Twitter. But we have Ben on this week. Next week, we're going to have Russell Dinks on, the Princeton alumni. He has done a ton with the University of Minnesota, the University of Clemson, Brown University, regarding race relations. The weekend after that, we're going to have the host of the CDS Mag podcast, one of the top five podcasts in the country, Chris Chavez. He's also a writer for Track and Field and Sports Illustrated. He will be on. And then we have the unbelievably, incredibly talented national championship coach, recently retired Walt Drenth, is going to be on to follow us to end the end of the month. So again, ladies and gentlemen, we appreciate your loyalty. We appreciate everything that you do for us, making us one of the top running podcasts in the country. And we truly look forward to doing better the next week. We'll talk to you later.
All this great stuff. We squat racks and bars and weights, and we loaded up. There's pictures of us in the middle of the night, like Tom's in the back of the truck holding on as I'm driving down the road. It was great,
man. There's some stories. They're just a place they just, like, we don't know what to do with this, so we're just gonna board it up and forget about it.
Yeah, pretty much. That was it.
And Ben, don't you wish you were in college coaching when you deal with all that?
I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about.
I don't anymore.